who have grown up in poverty and have a lack of faith in their future. Indeed, as one investigation put it, they provide an opportunity for career advancement through risk-taking and criminal activity, very often the only kind of success young people believe is available to them. Because of the current heavy emphasis in schools on academic success, some young people looked elsewhere for validation. Yet the New Labour era saw a crackdown on the symptoms rather than the causes of antisocial behaviour. The former government's approach, such as issuing thousands of antisocial behaviour orders, or ASBOs, served to magnify the problem in people's minds and criminalise the young people responsible, without helping in any way to turn their lives around. And to our shame, there are more young people behind bars in England and Wales than anywhere else in Western Europe. The numbers of young people aged between 10 and 17 with a custodial sentence trebled between 1991 and 2006. But prison most certainly does not rehabilitate. Some three-quarters of young people re-offend after release. New Labour's approach to crime as a whole was authoritarian, disregarding the main root cause, poverty. Before he became Labour leader, the rising star that was Tony Blair won plaudits by committing to a policy of tough on crime, tough on the causes of crime. But as Blair's political secretary, John McTurnan, has admitted, New Labour's strategy ended up as tough on crime, tough on criminals. Between 1993 and 2010, England and Wales's prison population nearly doubled, from 44,500 to around 85,000. What is startling about these figures is that the prison population was spiralling out of control, even as crime itself was falling. During the 2010 general election, the Tories put allegedly soaring crime rates at the forefront of their Broken Britain narrative. Their figures were a myth. According to the British Crime Survey, crime fell from 18.5 million offences in 1993 to 10.7 million by 2009. This success was not achieved because more people were thrown into prison, as many New Labour politicians would have us believe. Indeed, a secret government memo leaked when Labour was in power in 2006 suggested that 80% of the recent decrease in crime is due to economic factors. Or consider a 2005 study by the Crime and Society Foundation, which argued that escalating murder rates in the 1980s were the legacy of recession and mass unemployment. Indeed, as the economic boom that began in the early 1990s took off, crime rates fell right across the Western world. Even the Conservative-led coalition that took power after the 2010 general election accepted a link between crime and underlying economic factors. People have got more scared of crime, even as the actual levels have gone down. But this has everything to do with sensationalist journalism and inflammatory rhetoric on the part of politicians. Nonetheless, it is important to bear in mind that your risk of becoming a victim of crime depends a great deal on your class. The British Crime Survey shows that working-class people are significantly more likely to suffer from crime than middle-class people. Working-class people are often reproached for being authoritarian when it comes to law and order issues. But of course you're more likely to worry if the risk of crime looms larger in your community. There is little doubt that at the root of much crime in Britain is the illegal drugs industry. When many people think of council estates, they imagine a dirty stairwell littered with hypodermic needles. The truth is that people of all classes have experimented with drugs at some stage in their lives. Millions of teenagers, working class and middle class, have smoked a joint, and a very considerable percentage of young people have swallowed an ecstasy tablet on a night out. Looking at the available evidence in terms of teenagers and young people, there is not an obvious link amongst that group between socioeconomic status and levels of drug and alcohol misuse, says Martin Barnes, chief executive of drugs charity DrugScope. Indeed, cocaine has a long-established reputation as the middle-class drug of choice. A House of Commons Select Committee report recently denounced the fact that it seems to have become more socially acceptable and seen as a safe, middle-class drug. But when it comes to problematic drug use, the differences are striking. The Government Advisory Panel on the Misuse of Drugs published a report a couple of years ago, and it concluded that when you look at levels of drug misuse with older age groups, there was a very clear link with areas of deprivation and unemployment, says Martin Barnes. This was particularly striking when you looked at working-class communities devastated by economic crisis. The experience in some communities in the 1990s was that in those areas that were hit quite hard by unemployment, particularly young people's unemployment, we did see levels of drug misuse increase, not just heroin. Barnes is careful to say that, of course, other factors come into play, not least the rise of rampant consumerism in the 1980s and the greater availability of drugs. But he was in no doubt that people often made the leap from being a bit experimental with drugs to full-blown problematic drug use, either through despair or as a coping mechanism. You can see why drugs have strengthened their grip over some of the communities that never recovered from the battering they got under Thatcherism. The tragedy of hard drugs is most visible in Britain's crippled mining villages. I honestly think there wouldn't have been half the drug addicts and stuff like that if the mines hadn't closed, former Nottinghamshire miner Adrian Guilfoyle told me. A few years ago, Labour MP John Mann launched an inquiry into heroin use in the former mining community of Bassetlaw. It concluded that a health crisis comparable to a smallpox epidemic was raging in the heart of some of Britain's former coalfields. People growing up in the coalfields lacked the sense of identity afforded to their parents and grandparents who were a part of a stable and prosperous mining industry, the report said. The strongest substance used in these communities was beer, and stable employment allowed most a good standard of living. With the collapse of the mining industry, there is a need to escape, and heroin in these areas was associated with a need to get away from it all. Mining villages are train-spotting without the glamour, was its dismal conclusion. Modern conservatives blame many of these social problems on the excessive growth of the state, but they also favour another explanation, the breakdown of the traditional family. Single-parent families in particular have found themselves in the firing line. The working-class single mum is, after all, one of the most reviled chav icons. Fiona Weir of single parents charity Gingerbread enumerates some of the notions associated with the people she represents. Scroungers, spongers, lazy, doesn't want to work, happy on benefits, that group of adjectives. It's very pervasive and it's very directly relevant to a lot of the welfare reform debates that are playing out. To get to the heart of these stereotypes, Gingerbread conducted a wide-ranging study into the lives of single parents in modern Britain. What we found bore no relationship to the stereotype in the majority of the cases, she says, and what came through is an extraordinary, palpable sense of anger about the stereotyping. You would not think it from the way they are popularly portrayed, but 57% of single parents actually have a job. Rebecca is a young, confident single mother with two kids who lives on a Birmingham estate. She is lucky because she has a job she can juggle with being the sole carer of her children. She points to her 8-year-old daughter. The job I chose is a teaching assistant, which fits in around them. We're at the same school, so all the holidays we have together. I chose my job purposefully to fit around the children, and then my other one's at senior school, and her holidays are obviously the same, so work is fantastic for me. But I know that other single mums struggle, because when you have the 6-week summer holiday and Easter and whatever else, and you have to find someone to look after your kids. Despite the difficulties involved, most single parents want to work. According to the 2010 British Social Attitudes Survey, 84% of unemployed single parents want to either get a job or to study. But single parents face attack whatever they do. We get a phrase used a lot by single parents, which is, damned if I do, damned if I don't, says Weir. Because if you're on benefits, then you're somehow seen as a lazy scrounger. But if you go out to work, you're somehow seen as neglecting your kids and not knowing where they are while they run around wild. It's not shiftlessness keeping many single parents from working, but a number of barriers that are difficult to overcome, like having a job compatible with single-handedly raising a kid and affordable, accessible childcare. As Weir argues, stigmatizing single parents undermines their self-confidence and does nothing to help them get a job. The Tories often argue that family structure is one of the major deciding factors in whether a child does well at school and in later life, They are on a factual collision course with a recent study by the Children's Society, which showed that conflict in the family has 10 times more of an impact on a child's upbringing. The evidence base shows that most children from single-parent families turn out fine, says Fiona Weir. There are poorer outcomes for a significant minority, but when you analyze them, they correlate very, very clearly with things like poverty and conflict. And you get similarly poor outcomes in children from couple families that have similar levels of poverty and conflict. When people think of single mothers, it is often teenage girls that spring to mind. But in reality, only 1 in 50 single mothers are under 18. The average age for a single parent is 36, and over half had the children while married. Even so, there is no denying that Britain has the highest rate of teenage pregnancies in Western Europe. It is also impossible to deny the class dimension of this issue. Although the numbers overall are low, teenagers from manual backgrounds are 8 times more likely to become mothers than those from a professional background. The regions that top the teenage pregnancy tables are those areas where industry was destroyed and low-paid service sector jobs have filled the vacuum. Why? If doctor-turned-author Max Pemberton, writing in the Daily Telegraph, is to be believed, it is because for children from working-class families where aspiration is considered middle-class, choices in life consist of becoming a celebrity, working in a shop, or becoming a mum. The Holy Grail is ready access to a council flat and state benefits, which is precisely what having a baby gives you. As Fiona Weir points out, this unpleasant populist caricature of the crafty, benefit-seeking teenage mum is a myth. We come into contact with thousands of single parents, but somehow we just don't meet ones who fit this stereotype. How we are managing to avoid them, I don't know. As for 16- and 17-year-olds, they can't get the keys to a council house at that age. They either live at home or they go into supported accommodation. Middle-class teenagers are certainly less likely to fall pregnant in the first place, but they are also significantly more likely to have an abortion. I chatted to a few middle-class young women, some of whom had had a termination as teenagers. Their reason for not wanting a child now was the same, fear of the impact it would have on their career at such an early stage. But if you live in an area of high unemployment and with only unappealing low-paid jobs on offer, why wait for motherhood? In some cases, there will be an element of people who don't see a lot of routes for themselves in terms of what they can do with their life, says Fiona Weir. They might be looking for a sense of role and purpose and meaning and wanting to be useful and to matter. One recent detailed study showed that teenage pregnancy can bring with it many positives, particularly for young people from poorer backgrounds. Our research makes it clear that young parenthood can make sense and be valued, and even provide an impetus for teenage mothers and fathers to strive to provide a better life for their children, said Dr. Claire Alexander, one of the report's authors. Indeed, having a child can actually be empowering. As another study puts it, particularly amongst those who come from disadvantaged groups, for whom there may be little perceived reward for delaying parenthood, early motherhood can provide the opportunity to attain self-respect and adult status. We have seen that some of the things people associate with chavs have a basis in reality. There are some alienated, angry young people out there who take out some of their frustrations in antisocial ways. Things like crime and drug addiction are more common in working-class areas than in the average middle-class suburb. A working-class teenager is considerably more likely to give birth than her middle-class peer. But the reality is rather different from the vicious generalizations and victim-blaming that accompanies chav hate. Poverty, unemployment, and a housing crisis provide fertile ground for a range of social problems. These are working-class communities that took the brunt of a class war first unleashed by Thatcher 3 decades ago. Indeed, it would be far more startling if life had gone on, much like before, even as the pillars of the community collapsed, one by one. Proclaiming that people are responsible for their situation makes it easier to oppose the social reforms that would otherwise be necessary to help them. But such demonization does not stand up to scrutiny. People born into poor working-class communities do not deserve their fate, nor have they contributed to it. As the industries that sustained their lives disappeared, the once tight bonds holding many working-class communities together unraveled at a breathtaking pace. Those living there could once look forward to respected, relatively well-paid jobs. Their lives had structure. Today, large swathes of communities are haunted by despair, frustration, and boredom. Without real economic recovery, the social diseases that accompany hopelessness have flourished. It would be wrong to lay all the blame at the feet of the Tories. After all, New Labour left manufacturing to wilt too. At the end of their rule, they toyed with the beginnings of an industrial strategy to encourage a revival, but it was too little and, for them, far, far too late. Britain did not suffer the same ruinous level of unemployment as in the 1980s and 1990s, even as the economy went into freefall following the 2008 financial crash. But all too often it was part-time and low-paid service sector jobs that filled the vacuum, and they could not resuscitate the communities worst hit by the Thatcherite experiment in the 1980s. This is why many of New Labour's policies amounted to sticking plasters in communities ravaged by the Tories under their 18-year rule, plasters that are now being torn off, the wounds still bleeding underneath. It's not surprising that so many working-class people felt alienated from Labour. They felt it was no longer fighting on their side. Some succumbed to apathy, but not all. Deprived of a narrative to explain what was happening to their lives, some began to grope for other logics. It was not the wealthy victors of Thatcher's class war who found themselves on the sharp end. The frustrations and anger of millions of working-class people were channeled into a backlash against immigrants. Chapter 8. Backlash. Labour's treacherous lies and cardinal betrayal of the working classes is obvious to all, but the really good news is that the radical left have all but vanished from defending the working classes. Jonathan Bowden, BNP activist. It was not an ideal day for knocking on doors. The 2010 general election was only a couple of months away, and I was pounding the streets with a team of activists to get out the vote for a left-wing backbencher. The long, freezing winter of 2010 had finally drawn to a close, and it was one of the first sunny Sundays in months. Families were taking advantage of the warm weather, and houses with anyone inside were few and far between. After fruitlessly knocking on a few doors, a middle-aged woman wearing an apron finally answered. It was obvious she wanted to speak her mind.
"My son can't get a job," she said angrily. "But there are all these immigrants coming in, and they're getting all the jobs. There are too many immigrants."
It would be easy to dismiss someone with these views as a knuckle-dragging racist, but it was clear that she was not. I had to listen carefully to what she was saying because she had a fairly strong accent, a Bengali accent, to be precise. Here was a woman of Indian origin berating immigrants for taking jobs from British workers like her son. What was going on? That spring, activists of all political stripes found the immigration issue cropping up again and again. It had not come out of nowhere. Throughout the 2000s, a growing backlash against immigration had developed. Polls reflected an increasing hostility to more people entering the country. At the 2005 election, the Tories tried to tap into this groundswell with their infamous "It's not racist to impose limits on immigration" posters. But nothing focused people's minds on immigration more than the rise of the British National Party. In the early days of New Labour, back in 1999, the BNP had won just over 100,000 votes in the European elections. A decade later, they would poll not far short of a million. Far-right extremists celebrated jubilantly as BNP leader Nick Griffin and his Nazi-sympathising colleague Andrew Bronze became members of the European Parliament. The rising BNP tide spilled over into national elections, too. At the 1997 general election, it polled a paltry 35,832 votes, only a handful more than the eccentric National Law Party. 16 other parties did better. 8 years later, over 192,000 voted for BNP candidates, making the party the eighth largest in the country. There was huge relief following the 2010 general election that the BNP did not manage to pick up any seats. Yet it had still attracted nearly 564,000 votes. The BNP was now the fifth biggest party in Britain. Is the BNP's rise a sign that society is becoming more racist? The short answer is no. Back in 1958, a Gallup poll found that 71% of Britons opposed interracial marriage. and yet there was no racist party even fielding candidates. So few people subscribe to such a view these days that pollsters do not bother recording the figure. Today, Britain has the highest levels of mixed-race marriages in Europe, and only 3% admit to being very racially prejudiced. 4 out of 5 people claim to have no prejudice whatsoever. The irony is that Britain has become less racist at the same time as it is faced with the most electorally successful racist party in British history. To understand why people vote for the BNP, it is important to understand what the BNP is. Opinion polls are a bit unreliable, because outside of the anonymity of the polling booth, some potential voters are wary of admitting their support for the BNP, but they clearly show that the average BNP voter is likely to be working class. For example, one YouGov poll found that 61% of BNP supporters were in the bottom 3 social classifications, the C2s, Ds, and Es. The BNP has thrived in traditionally white working class areas with a long history of returning Labour candidates. Little wonder that the rise of the BNP has reinforced one of the popular chav caricatures of the white working class, a beer-bellied skinhead on a council estate moaning about hordes of immigrants coming in and taking our jobs. Indeed, it has suited many politicians and journalists to portray the BNP's rise as a matter of white working class people trying to preserve their identity from a non-white invasion. Frank Field, a right-wing anti-immigration Labour MP, told me that the BNP are appealing to a sense that people are losing their country without ever being asked whether that's what they want. But it's not simply racism that has driven hundreds of thousands of working-class people into the waiting arms of the BNP. The rise of the far right is a reaction to the marginalisation of working-class people. It is a product of politicians' refusal to address working-class concerns, particularly affordable housing and a supply of decent, secure jobs. It has been fuelled by a popular perception that Labour has abandoned the people it was created to represent. Karl Marx once described religion as the sigh of the oppressed creature. Something similar could be said about the rise of the far right today. The BNP is often compared to the European fascist parties of the 1930s, yet in reality it has flourished for completely different reasons. The fascism of the Great Depression era largely owed its support to small property owners and big businesses who felt threatened by a growing left, whereas today's BNP is a product of the left's weakness. With no powerful left to answer the bread-and-butter concerns of working-class people in the neoliberal era of job insecurity and housing crisis, the BNP has filled the vacuum. The Asian lady I spoke to was extremely unlikely to have plumped for the BNP come polling day, but she expressed the same anxiety about the impact of immigration on jobs as many BNP voters. This shows that the great backlash against immigration is being driven above all by material concerns. There was once a popular narrative that social problems were caused by the injustices of capitalism that, at the very least, had to be corrected. With these ideas forced out of the mainstream, it has been easy for the idea that all social problems are caused by outsiders, immigrants, to gain a foothold. It is a myth that, fanned by right-wing newspapers and journalists, has resonated in working-class communities across Britain. That is not to completely dismiss ethnic identity as a factor. The BNP does well in certain overwhelmingly white areas that have seen a recent influx of new ethnic minority residents. Former London Mayor Ken Livingstone recalls, "I was the candidate in Hackney North and Stoke Newington in 1977 when the National Front got 5% of the vote at the GLC, Greater London Council, election, just like the BNP did in London in 2008. And they were in Hoxton and Haggerston, the 2 southern wards. On the night of the GLC election, they didn't have a majority, but they were the leading party in those wards. But 2 years ago, they virtually got no votes, just a couple of percent. So I think you tend to get a problem of racism in an area undergoing transition." Hackney is one of the most mixed areas in the country, and as a result, the far right has died out there. But it flourishes in areas such as Barking and Dagenham, where mass immigration is a new phenomenon and where the BNP has done well, or, conversely, where there is very little immigration, but a tremendous fear of it. The demonisation of the working class has also had a real role to play in the BNP's success story.
Although ruling elites have made it clear that there is nothing of worth in working-class culture, we have been rightly urged to celebrate the identities of minority groups. What's more, liberal multiculturalism has understood inequality purely through the prism of race, disregarding that of class. Taken together, this has encouraged white working-class people to develop similar notions of ethnic pride, and to build an identity based on race so as to gain acceptance in multicultural society. The BNP has made the most of this disastrous redefinition of white working-class people as, effectively, another marginalized ethnic minority. Treating the white working class as a new ethnic group only does the BNP a massive favor, says anthropologist Dr. Gillian Evans, and so does not talking about a multiracial working class. It is unlikely that the BNP will ever win significant power, not least because of chronic incompetence and infighting, of the kind that crippled the party after the 2010 general election. But its rise is like a warning shot. Unless working-class people are properly represented once again, and their concerns taken seriously, Britain faces the prospect of an angry new right-wing populism. It was 10 days before Christmas, and Dagenham Heathway's mall shopping centre was thronged with bargain hunters. I was standing 13 miles east of the House of Commons, but it felt like a world away from the tea rooms of Westminster. Dagenham and neighbouring Barking are solidly working-class areas in the borderlands of East London and Essex. Dagenham was once the manufacturing hub of London. During Britain's industrial heyday in the 1950s, the iconic local Ford factory employed tens of thousands of workers. As one anti-racist campaigner put it to me, this was the BNP frontline. Barking and Dagenham first appeared on the national political radar in 2006, when the BNP stormed onto the local council with an apparent avalanche of support. With 11 seats in the bag, it was now the main opposition to Labour. It had only stood candidates in 13 out of the 51 seats up for grabs. This was a political earthquake whose tremors were felt across the country. Among the BNP's new councillors was Richard Barnbrook, who would go on to be elected to the London Assembly in 2008. Why was a once solidly Labour area defecting to what was until recently a fringe racist party? Margaret Owen, a retired home carer, was among the shoppers out that afternoon. I asked her if she lived in a tightly knit community. "No, I wouldn't say so," she said. "It's changing." When I asked her what she felt the number one issue facing the community was, she paused. "No, I mustn't." I gently pressed her again, and she looked cautiously from side to side before leaning in and whispering, "Well, it's all these foreigners coming in. Our borough is just changing. It used to be so nice." "Over what sort of period had this change taken place?" I asked. "It's changed in the last, what, 6 or 7 years? Yes, very much." It did not take long to understand the real reason for her dislike. "They get in the houses, and our people, our children, can't get the houses. Foreigners come in here and get places. I never got that. My children never got it. It's just going down the pan. If I can get out of Dagenham, I will." Many local residents harbour similar frustrations. Danny, a lanky, thoughtful man in his late 30s, has lived in the area since he was 8 years old. A printer by trade until the industry went bust, he found work in a warehouse in nearby Romford, and then in a furniture shop. After that he was made redundant and was out of a job for 2 years. Legislation introduced by New Labour compelled him to work for his dole money, and he was told that he would either have to work for a company for nothing or go into voluntary service. He ended up volunteering in a local charity shop. "Because if I work for a company, I'm earning the money when all I'm getting is my basic gyro, which is below the minimum wage." Like Margaret Owen, Danny insisted that housing was the main local grievance. "There's 10,000 people on the housing list who are trying to get a house," he said. Danny was wary about discussing the BNP's local rise. It was, he said, a dodgy subject, because he feared being labelled a racist. "Which is not good, because you think that at the end of the day there's been a lot of influx of foreigners. Whether they're taking the jobs and the houses is debatable. But they're being housed and fed, you know what I mean? So they've got to be put somewhere, which is obviously taken away from the people who've lived in Dagenham all their lives, putting taxes in, and they're scooped aside and getting pushed further and further out of Dagenham." A friend of his is bringing up a child on her own, and has been shunted around temporary accommodation for years.
But while there is not enough affordable housing to meet the need, a large prison is being built, a source of real exasperation among the locals. Why don't they build houses over there instead of building a prison? Unsurprisingly, the issue of jobs weighs heavily on Danny's mind. At its height, the Ford factory employed 40,000 people and was at the heart of the community. Sam Tarry, a leading local anti-racist campaigner who has lived in East London all his life, points out that part of Dagenham was actually built to house the workers from that particular factory. Danny paints a picture of insecure, low-paid work for many local people in the post-Ford era. Because obviously Ford was the main thing round here. I mean, I've not worked for Ford. There were other companies, but they're all going bust. That's the problem. You try and get a job, it's either before Christmas or it's temporary for 6 months for Christmas. January comes along and you're back in the same boat again, so it's a vicious circle. Or if you do go and get a job, they don't pay you enough to pay all your bills. Danny is not short of frustrations, but he has no faith in the ability of traditional political parties to alleviate them. I think a lot of the politicians have been to public school. When they come out, they just have no concept of real life. They've never scrimped or scraped. They've never had to do 14 jobs to earn a living or whatever, because they're on 60 or 80 grand a year, and then there was all this thing with expenses. They're taking the mick. I did not actually meet anyone willing to admit voting for the BNP, and Danny says he does not vote. But he eloquently describes some of the ingredients that, together, have made a toxic brew. Massive housing shortages, a lack of secure jobs and a convenient scapegoat, plus total disillusionment with the political establishment, added in for good measure. Brendan Duffield, a local trade union official who has lived in the area for 3 decades, is keen to stress that genuine mixing between communities does take place. "I've run football teams for over 20 years," he tells me. "I've had teams from youngsters right up to men's teams, and I've met every different nationality you could imagine. I've had Irish, I've had Scotch, I've had Africans, I've had Asians, and they've been great, supportive and everything. And everyone seems to get on very well, so I'm a bit amazed that people keep saying this is a racist area, because I've not really seen too many things in this area happening, like racial attacks. You get idiots in every area that you go in the country who've got nothing better to do." But Brendan had seen the impact that housing shortages have had. "I'm a bit ashamed to say, but I think this authority now has just started building 13 houses for the first time in over, I think it's over 30 years, since Margaret Thatcher was in." He's in no doubt that the issue, above all else, has unleashed a political whirlwind in his community. "I think if Labour would have carried on building houses in this area, you wouldn't have had half the trouble with the BNP. There was, undoubtedly, a steep rise in the number of foreign immigrants moving to Dagenham during the New Labour era. This has clearly been a disorientating experience for some who have lived there all their lives. Empirically, it's the fastest-changing borough in Britain. Empirically, that's a fact," says local Labour MP John Cruddas, who has represented Dagenham since 2001. But what has turned disorientation into outright resentment and hostility is what is on every local resident's lips. Housing. It's the lowest-cost housing market in Greater London, at a time of exponential rise in the value of property, and at the same time the effect of right to buy means that we have more of a private market, says Cruddas. "So you've seen the housing market in one small borough disproportionately take the strain in terms of broader patterns of migration into and within the borough. Looming over the whole borough is the shadow of right to buy, which massively depleted the borough's council housing stock. You've got many people here who took the opportunity to buy their house under the right-to-buy schemes in the 80s and 90s, says Sam Tarry. "Many of them have now reached a point where they've got grown-up children who are either having to live at home or having to move quite far out of the area to get a house, even just to rent a house, let alone to buy one. Many of the houses bought up by their owners ended up in the hands of private landlords. They have been particularly attractive to what Sam calls new kinds of migrant communities, particularly the African community embarking. Because if for the same rent you pay, for the price of a house, you can rent somewhere that's got 2-3 bedrooms, a back garden, a front garden, compared to the sorts of houses in Tower Hamlets, Hackney and Newham, it's a bit of a no-brainer in terms of wanting to have somewhere that's a bit more pleasant to live." Again, he identifies insecure employment as an issue further feeding the frustrations of local people.
The difficulty is that actually the generation of people in their late 30s, 40s, 50s is a generation of people who I think weren't employed by the Ford factory. They didn't have a skilled trade and left school certainly with no further education qualifications and very little basic secondary level qualifications, he says. And often you find people working in a flexible jobs market, the sort of job where you're more likely to be able to be hired and fired at will, where you're not necessarily going to have a pension. You're often on the minimum wage. It creates a further sense of insecurity, which, added to the concerns around housing and other local public services provision, starts to create a tense or uncertain atmosphere. Crudus agrees, blaming the extraordinary deindustrialization that has taken place. This was the centre of manufacturing in London, with its associated predictabilities in terms of pensions and employment, and it's no surprise that the BNP move in. In Barking and Dagenham, the BNP has cleverly managed to latch on to the consequences of unfettered neoliberalism. New Labour was ideologically opposed to building council housing because of its commitment to building a property-owning democracy and its distrust of local authorities. Affordable housing and secure, well-paid jobs became increasingly scarce resources. The response of the BNP was to delegitimise non-native competition, goading people to think, we don't have enough homes to go round, so why are we giving them to foreigners? Crudus describes the BNP as hinging their strategy on change versus enduring inequalities, and they racialise it. All issues, whether housing or jobs, are approached in terms of race. It allows people to render intelligible the changes around them in terms of their own insecurities, material insecurities, as well as cultural ones. Yes, it is a narrative based on myths. After all, only 1 in 20 social houses goes to a foreign national. But with the government refusing to build homes and large numbers of foreign-looking people arriving in certain communities, the BNP's narrative just seems to make sense to a lot of people. The BNP's strategy has been obligingly boosted by the right-wing tabloids. £5 million benefits for disabled migrants who flew home, screams one Daily Express headline. Secret report warns of migration meltdown in Britain, warns the Daily Mail. Illegal immigrant mum gets four-bedroom house, gasps the Sun. If you're a working-class person struggling to scrape by, who cannot even get an affordable home or at least knows others in that position, then being bombarded with these stories gives credence to the BNP narrative, that there aren't enough resources to go round, and immigrants are getting the lion's share of them. Coupled with this strategy is an audacious attempt by the BNP to encroach on Labour's terrain, with New Labour having apparently abdicated the party's traditional role of shielding working-class communities from the worst excesses of market forces. The BNP has wrapped itself in Labour clothes. I would say that we're more Labour than Labour are, says former local BNP councillor Richard Barnbrook. BNP literature describes the organisation as the Labour Party your grandfather voted for. Sifting through the BNP's policies exposed this as a nonsense. Their tax policy, for example, includes abolishing income tax and increasing VAT instead, a policy beloved of extreme right-wing libertarian economists that would benefit the rich at the expense of ordinary working people. The party freely adopts Thatcherite rhetoric, committing itself to the private enterprise economy, and arguing that private property should be encouraged and spread to as many individual members of our nation as possible. And yet, in communities such as Barking and Dagenham, the BNP has cleverly managed to package itself as the champion of the white working class. As well as counterposing the interests of white working-class people to those of ethnic minorities, the BNP has won support by throwing itself into community politics. Party activists organise fetes, help to clear rubbish, help out in pensioners' gardens, things that give the impression that they are rooted in the local community. You see lots of old people saying the BNP put on a bingo night, or the BNP wants people to stop gathering on street corners. And it's really classic community politics that masks what they're really about, says trade union leader Mark Sawatka. Disturbingly, it's not just former Labour voters that the BNP has managed to attract. One interesting factor, which we certainly saw in the 2006 elections, when the BNP got their 11 councillors elected, was the fact it wasn't just disenfranchised Labour voters, says Sam Tarry. They actually turned out great numbers who'd never voted at all before, so-called virgin voters. To actually motivate people who would usually just not bother with the political system, to actually go and take their first political step, and doing it hand-in-hand with the BNP, is an extremely worrying sign. The far right has managed to mobilize people who have never voted before because they feel that the traditional political parties simply do not represent their interests. It is clear that the BNP has thrived by offering reactionary, hateful solutions to the everyday problems of working-class people. But the demonization of working-class Britain has also played a role. For Tory, it has fueled a crisis of identity that accelerated the growth of the BNP and the wider anti-immigrant backlash. As well as recent national soul-searching about what constitutes Englishness and Britishness, the question raised in communities like Barking and Dagenham is, what does it mean to be working class? We've seen a switch into a sort of English nationalism, and you'll see a lot of the white families deliberately hanging out the English flag from their windows, almost as though they're staking out the territory in a slightly aggressive, non-inclusive way, says Tary. For me, there's an element there which I can't quite put my finger on about this sense of what it means to be from a working-class background, what it means to be English, and where your sense of identity and purpose and direction actually now comes from. Because of that decline of those traditional kinds of social structures that gave working-class people their sense of purpose and identity, and kinship and brotherhood through the trade union movement, and that still seems to have declined, even though we still have such a strong trade union movement in this area. Pride in being working class has been ground down over the past three decades. Being working class has become increasingly regarded as an identity to leave behind. The old community bonds that came from industry and social housing have been broken. But working class identity was something that used to be central to the lives of people living in communities like Barking and Dagenham. It gave a sense of belonging and of self-worth, as well as a feeling of solidarity with the other local people. When this pride was stripped away, it left a vacuum that the waking beast of English nationalism has partly filled. In a similar way, we have seen Scottish and Welsh nationalism gain new roots in the hitherto Labour-voting estates of Glasgow and the Rhondda Valley. But there is a key difference. Plaid Cymru and the Scottish Nationalist Party, SNP, shun ethnic-based nationalism in favour of a progressive-leaning, inclusive nationalism. Indeed, Plaid Cymru boasts of having more ethnic minority councillors than the other Welsh parties put together, while the first Asian elected to the Scottish Parliament was a member of the SNP. Central to the jingoist streak in English nationalism is the long, sordid history of empire. It's not that long ago, certainly when I was growing up, when you had the map with all the red blocks of where the British Empire ruled, trade union leader Billy Hayes notes. The centuries-old traditions of domination over other peoples have left a very large imprint in the national psyche, which the BNP constantly manipulates. The far right have switched their targets of choice over the years. Jews, Irish, blacks and Asians were each the villains at various points. Today, above all others, it is Muslims. An ugly wave of Islamophobia has accompanied the so-called War on Terror that was launched following the 9/11 attacks. British soldiers are at war with Muslim peoples in Muslim lands. Aided by hysterical media baiting of Muslims, the BNP has made Islamophobia into the very core of its propaganda. More perversely, the BNP has cynically manipulated mainstream multiculturalism with its focus on inequality as an issue of race. BNP propaganda has tapped into this by recasting white working class people as an oppressed ethnic minority, allowing it to appropriate anti-racist language. BNP leaflets are full of bogus talk of the white minority and anti-white racism. When the party was taken to court for its whites-only constitution, it retorted by asking why it should be any different from any other ethnic minority organizations, like the National Black Police Association. Of course, this represents a distortion of mainstream multiculturalism. Irrespective of its flaws, multiculturalism is essentially about defending the rights of ethnic groups who make up only 1 in 10 of the population in our overwhelmingly white society. But this is one of the consequences of eliminating class from our understanding of inequality, because a group like the BNP can simply argue that it is defending the rights of whites in a multicultural society,
just as others might defend the rights of Muslims or black people. It would be simplistic to maintain that the waves of immigration that took place under New Labour have had no impact in and of themselves. By historical standards, immigration has been high, and this alone would have provoked anxiety or hostility among some people. If you've always lived in a homogeneously white area, with little or no experience of or contact with different cultures, then a sudden change in your community may, to begin with, be a cause of confusion or alarm. Even though history has shown this tension dissipates within a generation or so, when genuine mixing has taken place, there may inevitably be tensions in communities undergoing transition. But economic insecurities have lent added ferocity to the backlash against immigration, and it is this that the BNP has so successfully manipulated. The wider issue is that there weren't jobs created for working-class people, and there weren't homes for their children to live in, says Ken Livingstone. And it's easy for the BNP to say, well, the blacks are getting it all. In reality, no one was getting any because they weren't building any or making any. It would be wrong to caricature communities like Barking and Dagenham as stuffed with angry white working-class people frothing at the mouth about immigrants. There are many who are disgusted with the BNP and have gone out of their way to welcome immigrants hailing from Eastern Europe, Africa, and the Indian subcontinent. When I asked Leslie, a home carer, and her friend Maura, a pensioner, what the main issues in the community were, they came up with the usual answer. That same old thing, housing. But that did not mean they had automatically rushed into the BNP camp. They're bad, they're trouble, very bad, they both say. I mean, I'm quite happy in Barking and Dagenham, says Leslie, and Maura agrees. We were born here and I'd never move out of Dagenham. They are both deeply scornful of the crap that the BNP are coming out with. At the moment, they're frightening people. They're saying old people can get chucked out of their house and it's given to the illegals. If they can say where the illegals are, fine. But there are no illegal immigrants in this borough. There's not. I mean, there's good and bad in everybody, but the BNP are very bad. They're very racist, aren't they? Asks Leslie, drawing a quick response from Maura. Very, very racist, they are. Although neither had faith in politicians at the national level, they did trust their local Labour councillors, but their impression of the BNP was of total incompetence. They have done nothing. You try and get hold of them, you can't get hold of them, and they have the cheek to stand and say that Labour's doing nothing. You can get in touch with the Labour Party, they do listen to you, they sort out your problems, but the BNP, no. Both are insistent that they mix with people of all backgrounds in their community. Leslie works with black managers and carers, for example. We've got an Indian family across the road from us, adds Maura. Every now and then they bring over a meal. Very, very nice. These were the sorts of sentiments that anti-racist campaigners built on in the run-up to the 2010 general and local elections. The Hope Not Hate campaign built a formidable network of campaigners, developed literature targeted at particular groups in specific localities, and exposed the incompetence of BNP councillors. Community organising was the backbone of the campaign, and trade unions played a central role in funding the effort and spreading the word among local working-class people. The campaign paid off beyond the wildest expectations of anti-racist activists. The fear was that the BNP would pick up at least one MP in the two local constituencies. The nightmare scenario was that it would take control of the council. In the event, the BNP was completely wiped out, losing all 12 of their councillors. Labour may have faced a disastrous rout at the polls in the May general election, but the local Labour Party took every single seat on Barking and Dagenham Council. BNP leader Nick Griffin responded by throwing his toys out of the pram, claiming that the English had been driven out of London. Yet there are no grounds for complacency. The BNP was defeated above all by vastly increased voter turnout, itself the product of an extremely effective campaign. In the Barking parliamentary constituency, the BNP vote went up from 4,916 votes in 2005 to 6,620 in 2010. But at the same time, overall turnout dramatically increased from 28,906 to 44,343, meaning the BNP vote share dropped. BNP council candidates did lose votes, but only around 100 votes in each ward. Indeed, many candidates topped 1,000 votes. Even before the impact of the most sweeping public sector cuts in modern history had been felt, the BNP had retained a solid base within Barking and Dagenham. The reality is that the grievances that spurred on the BNP upsurge are greater than ever. There is still a critical lack of affordable housing, and well-paid secure jobs remain thin on the ground. Working-class people in Barking and Dagenham, as elsewhere in the country, will continue to demand answers. The future of our communities depends on who gives them. The rise of the BNP is just the tip of the iceberg of the great anti-immigrant backlash of the early 21st century. There is no avoiding the difficult truth that the vast majority of Britons believe immigration levels are too high. Take one poll for The Sun in October 2007. Nearly two-thirds of the population wanted immigration laws toughened, but while only 6% of people in the top three social categories wanted immigration stopped altogether, three times as many in the bottom third wanted the borders completely sealed. These sentiments are not confined to areas that have experienced large influxes from abroad, like Barking and Dagenham. Across the country, anti-immigration has become the rallying cry of people who would never dream of voting for the BNP. It was the sort of thing we were told belonged to the 1970s. In defiance of some of the most stringent anti-union laws in the Western world, workers at the Lindsay oil refinery downed tools in a spontaneous walkout at the end of January 2009. Media commentators were dumbfounded as sympathy strikes spread to towns such as Grangemouth, Sellafield, Wilton, Staythorpe and Didcot, among others. This was not supposed to happen in 21st century Britain. But there was a twist to this apparent renewed union militancy. The media spin was that these were semi-racist anti-immigrant strikes in protest at foreign workers. There were close-up shots of placards being waved on picket lines demanding British jobs for British workers, repeating a disastrous promise by the then Prime Minister Gordon Brown at the 2007 Labour Party conference. Even to some on the left, this looked uncomfortably like chauvinism, reminiscent of the dockers who marched to support Enoch Powell's infamous anti-immigration Rivers of Blood speech in 1968. Media coverage went out of its way to confirm this interpretation. In one BBC bulletin, a worker was filmed saying, "These Portuguese in eye ties, we can't work alongside of them." But this turned out to be a gross distortion, and the BBC was forced to apologise for missing out the next sentence, "We're segregated from them." The worker meant that they physically could not work with foreign workers because they were prevented from doing so. The real reasons for the strike, carefully obscured by the mainstream media, shed light on some of the complexities underlying the working-class anti-immigration backlash in modern Britain. The Lindsay Refinery's employer, IREM, had hired cheap, non-unionised workers from abroad. Not only did this threaten to break the workers' union, it also meant everyone else's wages and conditions would be pushed down in a race to the bottom. "We've got more in common with people around this world than with the employers who are doing this to us," said Keith Gibson, one of the leaders of the strike and a member of the Trotskyist Socialist Party. BNP figures who tried to jump on the bandwagon were barred from the picket line. The demands of the strike committee included the unionisation of immigrant labour, trade union assistance for immigrant workers, and the building of links with construction workers on the continent. This was the opposite of a racist strike. However, the Lindsay strike was the exception rather than the norm. In an age of weak unions, the resentments behind the working-class backlash against immigration have lacked this sort of commendable leadership. The fear among large numbers of working-class people is that British jobs are being lost and wages are being forced down because of mass immigration. A glance at the figures might seem to support the conclusion that a majority of jobs are indeed going to immigrants. Between New Labour's victory in 1997 and its defeat in 2010, the number of jobs went up by 2.12 million. While the number of employed UK-born people has increased by 385,000, the number of workers born abroad has risen by 1.72 million. That means that more than four out of every five jobs created in Britain since 1997 have gone to foreign-born workers. But this fails to take into account the fact that the British population is actually growing very slowly.
There are problems with the figures available, not least because some foreign-born workers will now be British citizens, but they do give us a general picture. The British-born population of working age has only gone up by 348,000 since 1997, while the non-British-born working-age population has risen by 2.4 million. Nearly a million Britons have left the country since then, and there are a staggering 5.6 million Britons living abroad. It is often forgotten that migration is a two-way process. The bottom line is that the number of jobs going to British-born workers has gone up more than the British-born working population has increased. Less than three-quarters of non-Britons have had any luck getting a job, at least a job that found its way into the official statistics. It is statistically not true that immigrants are taking people's jobs. In any case, many of our essential services depend on foreign workers. The National Health Service would have collapsed long ago were it not for the thousands of doctors and nurses from other countries who have sustained it almost since its creation. Nearly a third of health professionals, such as doctors and dentists, are immigrants. However unfounded the fear of immigrants taking scarce jobs from natives, it has been allowed to take root in the popular imagination because of the continued decline of traditional skilled jobs. There has been no mainstream political voice to put this in the context of globalization and a lack of government support for manufacturing. Instead, we are bombarded on a daily basis by distorted propaganda from right-wing journalists and politicians. When Gordon Brown made the spectacular misjudgment of pledging British jobs for British workers, he only seemed to confirm the view that the jobs had hitherto been going elsewhere. When it comes to wages, the impact of immigration gets a lot more complicated. It might be expected that because immigrants would be willing to work for less, other workers would be forced to compete with them, thereby pushing everybody's pay down. A 2009 study by a leading Oxford economist and a senior Bank of England economist, Stephen Nicol and Jumana Salehin, found that wages were, overall, only slightly depressed by immigration. Their key finding was that the impact was not the same for everyone. It was those workers in the semi-skilled and unskilled service sector who suffered most. A 10% rise in the proportion of immigrants would cause a 5% reduction in pay for these groups. Another paper for the Equality and Human Rights Commission, EHRC, also found that the overall impact of immigration on wages was small. Ironically, it discovered that those most affected were likely to be former immigrants, because they would be competing for jobs that did not require language fluency, cultural knowledge, or local experience. Even so, it found that all workers in manual jobs could see their wages reduced because an employer could easily replace them with a foreign worker willing to accept less. The same was true for workers who were marginal to the labour market, those most likely to drop out or become discouraged workers, those who work in part-time low-skilled jobs such as single mothers and young people, and those who faced barriers to finding work such as inability to travel. Clearly, then, attitudes towards immigration are liable to depend on the class of the person who holds them. Indeed, prospective employers stand to gain from cheap foreign workers. The effect of immigration at the bottom of the labour market is different than it is on the people who are so pleased they can get a nice cheap nanny or someone cheap to do the plumbing, observes former Labour Secretary of State for International Development, Claire Short. When looking at the impact of immigration on jobs and wages, it has been increasingly fashionable among politicians and the media to contrast the hard-working immigrant to the layabout Brit. But it's not, of course, a fair comparison. After all, immigrants will have travelled hundreds of thousands of miles from poorer countries with the express intention of finding work. It is this that endows them with the qualities that employers find so desirable. As the EHRC report put it, immigrants are willing to work hard in jobs with no clear potential for upward mobility, such as most seasonal agricultural work, because they see this low-status work as temporary, because they are gaining non-financial benefits such as learning English, or because their wage does not seem low in comparison with earnings in their home country. To a certain extent, therefore, it is inevitable that immigrants will be more productive than native workers in certain roles. The impact of immigration has led the prominent Labour backbencher John Cruddas to describe it as a wages policy, that is, a device used to control the levels of pay. Crucially, former New Labour Cabinet Minister Hazel Bleers says, "There was actually an economic driver to keep the numbers coming because that kept wages down, in a way, and made us more competitive as an economy. And I think what wasn't fully appreciated was the human impact on families of doing that." "Was immigration deliberately used as a wages policy?" I asked. "No, I don't think it was a deliberate instrument of social policy, I don't. But I think that some of the effects were of that kind. But I don't think people sat in a room and said, 'Ha-ha, let's let millions of people in, and then we can grind the faces of the poor, of the working class.' I don't think Labour government is about that." When a number of Eastern European countries joined the European Union in 2004, Britain allowed their workers to immediately enter and freely seek work. None of New Labour's immigration policies caused as much controversy, especially when only Ireland followed suit. Critics claim that the decision led to a wave of cheap labour entering Britain, particularly from Poland. It clearly was madness for the government to allow the situation where Britain and Ireland were the only countries that allowed the accession states in before the two-year gap, says Ken Livingston. So they all came here. Now, it didn't have an impact in London because we're used to absorbing waves of immigrants. But in a whole range of the country where they'd never had to absorb immigrants, in rural areas, a load of people turn up from Eastern Europe. The wages are depressed, they work harder, they get the jobs. It was devastating. To the extent that immigration does have an impact on wages, the tabloid-driven campaign has aimed at the wrong target.